Artificial intelligence can drive cars and predict what you want to buy next. But can an AI system invent? Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP, hosted by Eli Mazur. Good lawyers effectively deal with the present. Very few have what it takes to create in the future. Professor Ryan Abbott is doing just that. He leads the Davis Project. It's the first time ever an AI machine has been named as an inventor on a patent application. Most thought the project was an interesting academic exercise that was unlikely to go anywhere. Some, uncharitably, dismissed it as a publicity stunt. Yet the Davis Project did a patent in South Africa, and an Australian judge ruled that AI machine can be recognized as an inventor. Even more significantly, the Davis Project raised awareness about the issue of AI inventorship among policymakers all over the world. But what does it mean for an AI system to be named as an inventor in the real world? On this episode, Eli and Professor Abbott talk about the Davis Project, whether everything will be obvious in the future, and Professor Abbott's fascinating new book, The Reasonable Robot. Clause 8 is a part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Heredy, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution.
First question that I like to start with is, do you remember when you first heard about patents and what was your impression of the role when you did hear about them?
And the first, I think, substantive memories I have of patents were being in law school and doing some consulting work with World Health Organization and with a couple of think tanks on access to medicine issues. And so I kind of first got exposed to patents in the context of life sciences and access, which is obviously an important dynamic to patents. And then the other exposure I had was a couple of friends of mine from high school had become patent agents and suggested I do the same thing because I had a scientific background or scientific training that would allow me to do that. So I thought, well, why not one more credential? So I went and studied for the patent bar, and I think that was my first real deep dive into the subject matter.
So you mentioned, you know, you were working in law school. You went to Yale Law School, which I'll talk about in a little bit. And you learned about patents in the context of, I'm guessing, access to pharmaceuticals in third world countries. Is that my impression of the kind of, I guess, work? So what was your impression about the role of patents?
Well, that was essentially looking at things like TRIPS and bilateral and regional trade agreements and the sort of restrictions that they would place on developing, not necessarily third world countries, that were looking to supply medicines to their populations or maybe do some manufacturing. And of course, you know, the access to medicine system works very differently in the United States than it does from the global South. And, you know, on the one hand, we want to make sure we have the best possible incentives in place to get pharmaceutical companies to develop life-saving medicines. We also want to make sure we have systems in place that can help people to access those. And so those reports were largely done, you know, I think for the benefit of developing countries to understand what flexibilities they had under international rules to take advantage of things like TRIPS flexibilities to help provide access. And so I guess, you know, one of the understandings of that was this balance we have between, you know, wanting to promote something and providing money and protection for investment, you know, but also wanting to make sure that that's done in a way that people can enjoy the fruits of that innovation and hopefully find ways in which the system can accomplish both of those goals without completely prioritizing one over the other.
You talked about the project that you worked on related to patents, but obviously I imagine, you know, you could have focused on any area of law. After law school, what really drew you to kind of still be focusing on patents up to this day?
I had a somewhat unusual career trajectory in law school because I was doing a dual degree in medicine and law. And there are not a lot of people who do MD-JDs. There are a fair number of MDs who do dual degrees. They're often MD-PhDs, you know, physician scientist researchers, or MD-MBAs, people who are going into administration or business with an MD. But for whatever reason, you don't see a lot of people do medicine and law. I think in part it's the time commitment, and in part it is because the skill sets are very different from one another. And when you look at what people with that combination go and do, they usually turn out to be either doctors who happen to be lawyers or lawyers who happen to be doctors.
Yeah.
and mainly doctors who happen to be lawyers, I think because the time commitment, again, is so much heavier on the medicine front. You know, by the time one has done medical school, residency, and fellowships, you know, I think it's hard to leave that behind. But I pretty early on thought that I wanted to be doing something primarily legal, and kind of looked at what people were doing. You know, there was, you know, finance, but I blew my interview with Goldman Sachs. There was, you know, medical malpractice, but that didn't seem super appealing to me. And there was regulatory work, and I have done some of that, but that's boring even to me. You know, and what's more exciting than regulatory work is patents. And I thought there might be a good niche for my skill set in basically biopharma intellectual property, you know, because a medical degree is in large part related to that. And so that's where I hung up my shingle.
You've become, I guess, famous in the patent world, mostly for your DABIS, the artificial invention project that you're leading. The ultimate question is, can AI be named as an inventor on a patent? Can you tell us, like, when did you first start thinking about this issue?
Well, it was around 2013, 2014, and I was doing two things. I was teaching patent law, and in particular law on inventorship, and I was working as a patent attorney in the life sciences. And I was noticing that companies were offering to do research where they would essentially have, you know, for example, an AI looking through a large library of antibodies and finding an antibody that might treat some compound you were interested in, or bind to some compound you were interested in. You know, broadly in the life sciences, people have used, you know, AI or, you know, at least computers pretty intensively for things like mass throughput screening of candidate selection of things. And it just sort of got me thinking that what this company, you know, what I recall some vendor advertising they were doing struck me as, well, you know, when we have a person do that, we make them an inventor and we own the patent. So what happens if you have a machine do it and you don't even have a person who's doing that conception act? Yeah. I wonder if anyone's ever thought about that. And it turned out lots of people had thought about that, or at least several, since the 60s. And largely sort of academically, like, well, hypothetically, if you ever had a machine invent something, you wouldn't need a patent because machines don't care about patents. So that would be stupid. And I thought, well, obviously machines don't care about patents, but that's not quite right, because who does care about patents are life science companies. And if I can build an AI that can select a new drug compound or repurpose an existing drug compound, you know, I need a patent for that sort of activity to really work for me. And so I really didn't see from a commercial perspective why it should make much difference if I was running a division at Pfizer and went to 400 pharmacologists and said, find a new vaccine for COVID. Or if I went to some team operating an AI and said, you know, here's COVID, find me a new vaccine. So I had been doing this sort of thing with AI. Different sorts of AI in different sorts of fields. But I wrote something academic on it and basically argued, well, this sort of behavior is something that the patent system really ought to encourage. Because if we can build machines that can invent, you know, all the better for society in terms of the purpose of the patent system, which is generating more socially valuable output. And if we believe in the patent system as a means of incentivizing these sorts of behaviors, you know, yes, the machine doesn't get a patent, but the owner of the machine would get a patent, and this would encourage people to make and use these machines, and thus we get more inventions, which is really the whole purpose of everything. And if you had a machine that functionally invented and not a person, it would be appropriate to name the machine, because it would be transparent to the public of how an invention came about. It would assist with chain of title and entitlement issues, which we could get to, and it would keep someone from taking credit for work they haven't done. So if, you know, in 10 years we have an AI that can invent 10,000 new useful drugs, it would really change what it means to be an inventor if I could put my name on all of that and say that I had invented it. And I went out and started talking about this, and there was some vague interest. And over the course of a few years, companies were starting to get more interested in this as being an issue. You know, teams were getting larger, more interdisciplinary. There were companies that were specializing in building AI systems for these sorts of things, particularly in the life sciences. But very little guidance on, well, what happens if you don't have a traditional human inventor? A lot of assumptions that you maybe couldn't get a patent, because some patent laws do either say you need a human inventor or use language that suggests you need a human inventor. Not everywhere, though. Israel doesn't require you list an inventor. Cyprus and Monaco, which are EPO member states, have reported they don't require an inventor to be a natural person. But everywhere that law has come about, you know, has either been based on an assumption that people are the thing that invents, or that we don't want to have corporate inventors, because it would be easier for IBM to say IBM invents all their patents, but that would leave out human inventors who are at least now entitled to moral acknowledgement that they have done this thing and may be entitled to some economic benefits, either under contract or in jurisdictions like the EU, where there's special rights for inventors for very profitable inventions. You know, a company literally acts through human agents, though, and an AI doesn't, at least the sort of AI we're talking about. So the situation is really, I think, not that similar. And there was really no guidance at all about, well, so what happens if this happens? And one of the reasons we did this project was to generate case law on what happens with an AI generator.
I guess I'm interested in that history. How did you end up working? You know, Dr. Stephen Failure, who I think created the Abbas, he was working for a decade or so. And then how did you and him connect on filing these patent applications?
Dr. Thaler was someone that I had interviewed when I was working in this subject purely academically as one of the earliest people to say they had had AI making new inventions.
I see.
And he, you know, has been pioneering his neural network-based AI architecture for decades. Other people said they did it using, you know, genetic programming or even using expert systems, some before and some after him. But he, you know, was one of the people leading in the space of having AI do this sort of work. And I spoke at a conference where a colleague came up to me after and said, so why is it we don't have a case on this? And I said, well, everyone I'd ever interviewed who said they had had this happen said, oh, our patent attorneys just said, list yourself on this. There's no rule for it. No one will ask. Of course, that's a good way to get a patent, not necessarily to have an enforceable patent. If in the U.S. you're deposing someone who's listed as an inventor and suddenly they say, you know, actually the machine said it and I didn't really get it, but I gave it to the patent attorneys and, you know, they said, put your name on it. And I said, fine. You know, that's likely to.
Yeah. So that's actually an interesting point. I was going to talk to you later, but I think it's a good time. So yeah, in the U.S., a patent can get invalidated if you list inventors wrong. So theoretically, let's say if an AI theoretically invented something and not the person who's listed, it should be invalidated. Are you surprised that there hasn't been any challenges based on that up to this point? Or why do you think that is?
No, not surprised. And I think one way to see that is to actually pivot to the related field of AI-generated works and copyright. So, you know, there isn't much precedent for AI law, you know, AI-generated inventions and patent. There are laws for AI copyright. And the UK was the first country in 1988 to say, if you have a computer-generated work that would normally get copyright, but you don't have a human author, we legally deem the producer of the work, the person who undertakes to have the work created, as the author of the work, and it gets a shortened period of protection.
Yeah.
And there had been discussions about that for some time before then, and that was 1988, and there has been one case on it involving that law, and that case didn't even really look at this issue. Now, the UK IPO, the United Kingdom Intellectual Property Office, is doing a consultation right now, not only to look at whether the law should change with patents, but also copyrights. And people have said, well, you know, maybe we just don't need this law at all, and this isn't an issue, because we haven't really ever had any cases on it. And I think the reason for that is a few. You know, one is you don't have to register copyrights in the UK, and copyright litigation is reasonably rare. And subsistence of copyright, whether or not a copyright exists, is rarely challenged. And if someone did happen to know an AI-generated work was AI-generated, because of this law, they really wouldn't have a grounds to probably challenge it anyway. But more importantly, while people have been using machines to make, you know, artistic stuff for a long time, only very recently have computers gotten good enough at doing that that there's going to be a commercial market for it.
Okay.
So a few years ago, you had this Christie's art sale for almost $500,000 of an AI-generated, you know, piece of artwork. AI-generated artworks are now making up lots of NFTs and even AI art galleries. And so even though this was sort of a thing that was happening, it has only recently become a commercially relevant thing that was happening. And so now is, I think, when you were going to start getting significant litigation over it. You know, similarly for patents, you know, it's a lot harder for an AI to invent something than make a, you know, piece of artistic work. So even though computers have, you know, been doing this in some shape or form for some time, you know, it's going to be a while before they do it at such a level that it is really a commercially substantial amount of activity. I will mention that Lord Justice Burse, who in our UK Court of Appeals decision ruled in our favor that, you know, he did think our invention should receive a patent. But that was a split decision, and Lord Justice Arnold and Lady Justice Liang didn't agree with him. He mentioned at a conference, I was on a panel with him last month, that he had had a case of an AI-generated invention a decade ago involving an AI-generated brake component, where the parties had all sort of agreed that actually this design just came out of an AI, but they weren't in that case debating whether or not there was a patentable sort of thing, so it didn't really come up as an issue.
So we'll get to those different decisions. I guess I want to kind of go through that history. So I'm guessing you were at this academic conference. Somebody said, why hasn't there been a case? And then you kind of teamed up with Dr. Feiler to file these patent applications around the world, right? That's kind of the history with that.
And then that, you know, colleague who was Malte Kohlner said, well, we ought to do a test case. And I said, great, who do you have? He said, well, you'd have to go get the guy. So yeah. I called Steve up, and Steve was on board. And then a group of me and a couple others wrote the patent applications. We submitted them internationally. And then here we are.
My question is, you know, in your book, and I think you mentioned it, that almost every country except, you know, maybe Israel requires a patent application to list a natural person. In your book, you point out that the U.S. Patent Act says that inventors should be individuals. Why did you adopt the strategy of filing applications and then seeing what the courts say instead of, you know, I think even your impression was that if you look at the plain language, the impression was that the law did not allow that. Why not lobby, you know, all these bodies to change that, or, you know, kind of advocate in that way? Why go through the strategy of actually filing patent applications?
I suppose because I'm more a litigator than a lobbyist. So, you know, I wouldn't really even know how to go about doing the second thing, except really that the cases have proven pretty useful in a lobbying function.
Yeah.
And there has been some legislative activity really over the past year about this kind of in, I think, the right direction. You know, the different patent laws, you know, are phrased a bit differently about, again, whether an inventor needs to be a natural person. You know, Australia, for example, when we get there, again, found that an inventor could be a machine.
Yeah.
The U.S. never says an inventor needs to be a natural person. It uses words like individual, you know, but individual sometimes means a natural person and sometimes it doesn't. And, you know, it is entirely consistent with the purpose of the Patent Act to interpret it where an individual in the context of an invention could be a machine, and really that all the right outcomes result from that interpretation. And there is, you know, in our view, no reason to take an overly narrow textualist interpretation of it. You know, for example, whomever in 35 U.S.C. 271, which refers to infringement, you know, if, you know, whoever can refer to anything, including a state or a corporation, as something that could commit infringement. And if whoever can refer to a company or a state, I see no reason why individual couldn't conceivably apply to a machine.
My understanding is that you thought there is a feasible way for the courts to agree. And I guess I want to talk more about the strategy, because I found it interesting. The two inventions, I guess, the two applications that you filed for were, one was for a lid for a food container, from what I understand, and the other one is for method for controlling lights in a warning system. How did you pick those two? Was there some kind of strategy in mind with regards to that? And, you know, why file two patent applications?
Dabis, which is Dr. Thaler's latest iteration of AI, you know, works fairly autonomously. So if you go back to how his AI worked in the 90s, you basically had at least two neural networks. And you had one neural network that you would train on data. Say you would show it a bunch of car suspension designs, and it would store this data by altering its own connection weights. It would then automatically alter its own connection weights. This would corrupt the data it had seen, and it would output this new data. And essentially what that was doing was generating new designs. You would then train a second neural network on the data the first one had seen, so it could tell you if output was new. You would train it on how to model the utility of something coming out of the first network, and you would tell it what you were looking for. So you might say, I'm looking for a car suspension that maximizes friction, and you set the thing to run, and it comes up with 100,000 designs, and it says, here's the one that most maximizes friction. That was parametric optimization, which was, you know, pretty narrow in terms of what it could do. Now it has hundreds of artificial neural networks, each one basically encoding for a concept. The machine is mentored by a person at combining individual complex into simple ideas. And then in unsupervised runs, it combines simple ideas into complex ones and identifies when it has an idea that has value. And for example, the way it could do that is, you know, you tell the machine, one of the things I want you to find is something that prevents death. You know, there is a, you know, series of networks that represent the concept of preventing death. And so the machine said, you know, I have an idea that if you have a light that flashes in this particular manner, it could preferentially attack human attention in an emergency situation, and this would prevent death. And that was essentially the claim that came out with respect to the what we're calling the neural flame, which is that flashing light. So we got that, and then we decided that we should do a prior art search and see if that looked patentable before we filed it, you know, just in case. Well, as you know, a lot of times you think something's patentable, you file it, and turns out someone in 17th century Russia had come up with the idea first. While we were doing that, the machine said, oh, by the way, here's an idea for a beverage container. And we said, well, why not take two shots just in case one of these inventions doesn't work out? Better to have more chances.
The argument, somebody's listening to that, and maybe correct me if I'm not properly understanding the AI aspect of it, is...
Hopefully someone's listening to
it. Is that somebody... There has to be a human involved in all that, right? Somebody has to give some prompt to the AI, to the Dabis, to say, you know, this is what we're looking for, at least broadly. And then somebody has to look at least at the output and say, well, this is a great invention, right? There's a human involved in this whole process. And somebody, you know, just to play devil's advocate, says, well, this is really the inventor, because, you know, he's kind of identifying, it's not this machine that's automatically filing a patent application based on its best idea, AI, maybe in the future, but not now yet. It's a human who's really evaluating all that. And I think, as you write, there's AI-assisted innovation going on all the time. I mean, how would you respond to that? Why is that human shouldn't be the inventor as opposed to the Dabis itself?
Sure. And no, to be clear, there's people all over this thing and any AI. You know, Dabis and we don't have general artificial intelligence in the sense that Dabis didn't wake up one morning, have an existential crisis, and decide it was going to invent something and teach itself how to do that. But nor really did any of us. I mean, I think the test for inventorship is not, was someone involved in this process? You know, there is a test for inventorship, which differs by jurisdiction fairly significantly. But in the U.S. is, did you conceive of this invention? And so for me, it's not, well, were there a bunch of people involved, but was there someone who met the test for conception? Now, there's a number of ways you can do that. You can find a problem to be solved. That can sometimes make someone an inventor, where that's the clever bit of an invention. But usually it's not. Usually we know what we want. We want a better car, you know, suspension, and we know the sorts of fitness parameters in a car suspension, or we want an antibody to treat COVID-19, and we have a pretty good sense of what that will look like. I mean, we may even know what the solution is. We just don't know how to get there. So it's not generally telling a machine to solve a problem. And similarly, you could be an inventor by training a machine to solve a problem. So, you know, say you want a better car suspension and you are a person who trains the machine with the car suspension and adjusts how it's working and looks at the output and carefully selects training data. I think that would give you a pretty good claim of being an inventor. But maybe that's harder where you have, you know, teams of hundreds or thousands of people contributing to programming in AI. And more challenging where the people who program or train the AI aren't the people using it. So let's say that you do design an AI to make better car suspensions and you're at Google and you license it to Siemens. And now there's a team at Siemens that is, you know, turning it on and getting these new car suspension designs. Well, if you were at Google, you really couldn't be an inventor on that output because you wouldn't even know what the output is. You know, you would know that you've made something that will go on to make a car suspension, or so you think, but you have no idea of the actual designs that are coming out. And then finally, as you say, sometimes recognizing the value of something can make you an inventor. And so I think there's a good claim, you know, you have this AI, it has 10 car suspension designs, and you go and test them and find the best one. I think that pretty clearly makes you an inventor. But if, you know, you've licensed this AI and you say, I want a better car suspension, and it pops out, here's the best conceivable car suspension someone could design, I don't think that that person receiving that output has done anything involving conception or inventive skill. And thus, I would say, really shouldn't qualify to be an inventor on that basis. Now, you know, the facts of that sort of entire AI process and the people involved can vary a lot. And almost all the time, certainly there is someone you could make a colorable claim as an inventor, but not all the time. And in our case, though Dabbous was built and trained to invent, it was not built or trained to invent any particular thing. And it identified these two ideas of value before a person saw them.
Is that the line that you would draw, like whether AI should get the credit or a person, whether the suggestion that something is of value as an invention is by the AI? Where's the distinction? Because I think even in your book, you talk a lot about how people use AI as part of an invention, inventing all the time. So is it a person just using it, or is it really the AI that's coming up with this invention?
Right. So I think, you know, firstly, it depends, to give the lawyer's answer, you know, and secondly, it depends where you are in the world, because Germany and the US have different tests for this. But thirdly, I think, you know, the right way to handle it is to analogize it to teams of people. You know, you have a lab, you have five people in it, you know, someone goes to you, the patent attorney, and says, here, all five of us are inventors. Some patent attorneys will say, okay, fine. Some will say, well, should we, you know, maybe explore that a little bit? And who is it? Who did what? And one of the things that it's interesting about this case, even for people who aren't right in AI and IP, is it kind of illuminates how mushy inventorship is as a concept. Yeah. I mean, in some sense, we all kind of think we know it when we see it, you know, but in other senses, it can get awfully tricky where you have teams of people doing different things, and who was it really that contributed in an inventive way, and who was really just a skilled technician? And it probably, you know, as a commercial matter, will rarely matter that much if your research team is all at Pfizer because, okay, so, you know, one of these people maybe should or shouldn't be on the application, but at the end of the day, it's Pfizer's. You know, it will matter where some of the team is at Pfizer and some of the team is at Novartis, and you have a research collaboration agreement where, you know, each company owns the inventions of its employees. And, you know, as teams get bigger and people collaborate more and people use AI more, you know, kind of moral inventorship issues are going to take on more economic importance for entitlement reasons.
And, you know, I think that's a very interesting area because I think this is a practically patent attorneys deal with it every day in the U.S., at least trying to figure out who the inventors are. Because as you say, a patent can be invalidated based on that basis if you don't get it right. Would you support getting rid of identifying inventors altogether because of how complicated and almost maybe inconsequential it is? Because as you say, if 20 people work for a company, The company will still own the patent at the end of the day, figuring out which of these 20 people actually were involved in coming up with this invention, which AI they use, and so forth. Should that requirement be passed, or do you think there's some value in identifying inventorship?
Well, it would certainly make life easier for patent attorneys. I have heard some kind of wistfully wish that just companies could be inventors. Yeah. Although, on the other hand, it is nice to have more work for patent attorneys. And that was one of the major reasons for doing the test case in the first place, to designating inventors, you know, for a couple reasons. You know, first, again, economically, it is important to the extent that entitlement often, you know, or does flow from inventorship. And so designating an inventor does clarify chain of title. And you could save a lot of work up front not dealing with that. But presumably then if you were, again, litigating it, you'd have to demonstrate your right to the patent through employment contracts or whatever and inventorship. So it does serve that important commercial purpose. But secondly, you know, inventors do have, you know, well, they certainly do under current law have moral rights in receiving acknowledgement for having done something. And even though that right may not have a whole lot of direct commercial value, I think it is something that inventors tend to be, you know, very protective of and attached to. Now, a machine doesn't care about being acknowledged, and one certainly isn't listing a machine on a patent for the purpose of providing a right to a machine. But I do think that the same basic rationale applies there, where, you know, listing that Dabbous invented this is being transparent to the public that this was something an AI made. And that may be interesting in the future. You know, in 10 or 20 years, AIs like Dabbous or made by DeepMind may get very, very good at doing this sort of thing. I mean, it may be in 20 years when we get COVID-25, Pfizer and GSK and Johnson & Johnson just go to AIs and say, quick, we need a vaccine and an antibody. And really, that's just how people solve problems in that field. In which case, I think it will be good for the public to know how invention is made, and for all sorts of policy discussions around, you know, encouraging and protecting investment. And it also provides some acknowledgement for the people building the AI. You know, the same way if my PhD student gets a patent on something, unless I'm a bad supervisor, I'm not directly taking credit for that. But you know, it is a bit of acknowledgement to me that I played a role in someone's development. So I think the system works reasonably well. We just need to be transparent about designation.
Those are interesting points. And we'll get back to some of those policy arguments, some of the results that you've had in the courts. As you've mentioned, the EPO, the UK, and the USPTO, they looked at these issues closely, but they all came to the conclusion that AI cannot be named as an inventor. And South Africa and most, I guess, significantly, probably Australia came to the opposite conclusion and they sided with you. Were you surprised by any of these outcomes?
I mean, I suppose, you know, as an initial matter, the idea that a patent office would not accept an AI designated as the inventor kind of would have been the path of least resistance and the, you know, plainest interpretation of language. Yeah. So it wasn't surprising that that was something that happened. I think that opinions have changed really pretty significantly on this in the past couple of years, you know, and part of that is reflected in South Africa and Australia. You know, South Africa does not do substantive patent examination, but these patents were both substantively examined by the UK IPO and the European Patent Office. The reason we filed them there first, in fact, was so that we would get preliminary examinations from those offices as to novelty, inventive step, and utility before, you know, to make sure that these were indeed the sorts of things you could get patents on before we corrected the inventorship and those offices denied it. You know, I'm not really aware of another case in any of those jurisdictions where a patent has been denied based on, you know, failure to designate an inventor, you know, or certainly not in this manner. So I think really even in those jurisdictions, this was a bit unprecedented. South Africa does do formalities examination, though, and everywhere the applications have been denied rather than rejected, it's been on a formalities basis. So, you know, they haven't said much about it yet. But Australia, in the Federal Court of Australia, Justice Beach wrote a 41-page reasoned decision, you know, holding that AI-generated invention should be patentable. It is consistent with the purpose of the Patent Act. that there's no reason why an AI that functionally invented couldn't be listed as an inventor. And at least in our case, that Dr. Thaler had the clearest claim of entitlement to the patents. You know, there isn't a statute that says if you own a machine that makes an invention, you own that invention. But it is consistent with common law rules of property ownership. If I own a 3D printer that prints a beverage container for me, I own that. So why not one that makes a patentable design for me? And that's really a principle of property ownership that dates back to Roman law and the concept of accession. You know, and you see it also in things like if you own a tree, you own fruit from the tree, or if you own a cow, you own its calf. Or actually one of the very early Irish copyright cases in, I think, maybe even the 6th century, where the King of Ireland said, you know, to each book its copy. Justice Burse, in fact, hopefully pointed that out in the Court of Appeal hearing. You know, the UK, well, I was moderately, you know, enheartened to see the Court of Appeal split on this. It is now we have now put in an appeal to the Supreme Court. Well, that is discretionary.
Actually, going back to Australia, so were you kind of cheering up and down, jumping up and down when that decision came down? Or was it something that you thought was in the realm of a reasonable possibility when you started this journey?
Well, I mean, a couple things. You know, Allens was working with us in Australia, and I have to say the team there was really outstanding and was finding 17th century Blackstone references that I would never have found. So they did a really good job. You know, also in the initial hearing, I think the judge, you know, sometimes judges are more transparent than others about how they're leaning. You know, the judge in Australia did seem to be pretty receptive to our arguments at oral hearing. You know, in the Eastern District of Virginia, you couldn't have had a judge tip much more, you know, how she was feeling. So I wasn't holding my breath on that case either. Yeah. But I was cautiously optimistic in Australia. I was in England at the time when we had the decision handed down, which was at like 3 a.m. for me. And I woke up for it and I had about 60 seconds of trouble logging in. And by the time I logged in at a minute after the hour, I heard the judge say, you know, and that's my decision. And, you know, nothing further will be said on the matter. And we all got off teams. And I thought I woke up for that. But then when, you know, I got Allens on the phone after and we'd won, it was pretty exciting. Even for 3 a.m, there was some hopping.
Where do you see this project going, kind of the Dabas in the future, now that these jurisdictions have ruled? Like, where do you see this kind of ending up?
Sure. Well, I think this project has a whole lot of interesting stuff in it. You know, one being the narrower issue of what do you do if you have a machine invent something, you know, but I think it is really a whole broader sort of set of issues, you know, including what do you do when machines create things with other sorts of intellectual property rights like copyright and design rights, you know, or even other sorts of areas of the law that are touched on by that. And really, in some sense, it is saying, you know, how should the law adapt as we move from a paradigm where people do things to people building machines to do things? And how do we have laws and rules in place that kind of help us as a society get as much value as we can from this and limit the risks as much as possible? So I see it as kind of a case in a much broader discussion about, you know, the role of technology and the law. And I have been very pleased, you know, plus it's an area I work in, that policymakers have been fairly actively discussing this sort of thing over the past few years. You know, the European Commission, for example, just published some draft AI regulations. Patent offices around the world are doing consultations on this. You know, the UK IPO, for example, but also India just did a parliamentary consultation recommending the law be changed to protect this. The president of South Korea a couple months ago said that the law should protect this sort of thing. So I, you know, I see that this is going in the direction of, you know, more forward-thinking actions on behalf of patent offices and policymakers in terms of, you know, how best to enjoy the fruits of these machines we're building.
And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you hinted in the beginning that one of the reasons you pursued this strategy was to try to raise awareness about the issue. And I guess in that sense, it has been a clear success from everything that you describe, and the, you know, president of South Korea is talking about it and being asked about it, then it seems that you know, and they weren't before you started this, right?
Well, no, I appreciate that. No, for sure. I mean, we did this for a number of reasons, you know, one of which was, I think, you know, robots are fun to talk about and being a patent attorney can be boring to some people. So this really, you know, at a bar when the tax lawyers start talking, you can mention this case and, I mean, really just kick us up a notch. But, you know, it was to provide some guidance for industry. It was to really start a discussion about what we ought to do with this sort of thing rather than people sort of whispering about it. And, you know, 20 years from now, after all these companies have adopted or not adopted AI, you know, you don't want to then find out that you can't protect this sort of stuff. You know, so it was to start a discussion and find the right policy and also to advance this particular argument that really this is a valuable sort of activity. It is something we should incentivize through the patent system, you know, and this would be the way to do it.
There's a Wall Street Journal article about Davis and you, and one of the quotes there was by a patent attorney. He goes, "I'm not sure we truly have AI yet where machines are doing the inventing." What is the disconnect there in terms of, you know, patent attorneys being skeptical that AI is doing the inventing? Is it, are we patent attorneys behind the times, or what do you think the disconnect is there?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think it's a few different things. I mean, firstly, I hear that a lot less now than I did 2 years ago. AI is moving so quickly and improving so much in terms of not fundamentally what it does, but in how, you know, effective it is at doing that. You know, when I speak to people in industry, I now usually don't get that sort of response. You know, which again, I think kind of analogizes to the AI making copyrightable sort of stuff. You know, people a few years ago were skeptical AI could make anything that would normally get copyright, even though the bar for that is so low. And, you know, right now I can go online and go to, you know, three commercially available websites where you can just make AI art by typing in a couple of words. And it's really hard to argue that AI can't do that sort of thing. You know, and on the patent side, you know, whereas I used to speak to drug companies that were interested in it or thinking about it, you know, now I often sponsor, yes, we've just spent $1 billion on our new AI division. And, you know, this is something that we are really interested in. I think there's two other things going on too. And part of this is essentially definitional. You know, when people talk about AI inventing, people talk about different sorts of things and they mean different sorts of things. You know, there was a European Commission report not long ago saying that AI wasn't really inventing because there was always a person causally involved in the invention. And that is certainly true. But for the reasons we discussed, being causally involved in an invention is not a grounds of being an inventor under U.S. or really any kind of patent law I'm familiar with. You know, but again, some people are saying, well, there's no AI invention because there's people involved. Well, yes, but is there someone who is doing the traditional act of invention? Now, you could also, and again, this may vary by jurisdiction, say, you know, okay, so let's say an AI just spits out, this is the world's best car suspension. I think it's fine that the first person to see that should be an inventor, regardless of whether it involved inventive skill. And you could do that, right? And that would just sort of be, you know, I think you would want to think about the policy behind doing it, but some of what it means to be an inventor, for example, in that context, hasn't been that well fleshed out. And I think that's something we're looking for from the cases. You know, the final piece is some people think an AI can't invent regardless of functionally how good it was, because an AI doesn't have the sort of moral capabilities of invention because it lacks semantic understanding. Right. And in that view, right, even if you could just go to an AI and say, can you cure COVID? And the AI says, yes, and here it is. You know, that wouldn't be inventing because the AI wouldn't really understand what COVID was, what it was doing, what it was curing, and its place in the universe. And I tend to think that that's sort of the wrong way of looking at it, because what the patent system is really designed to do is, you know, promote a certain sort of behavior that has a social benefit, right? We all have this amount of prior art. We know what we want. We want cures for COVID. We know that there's this sort of activity that will get us from prior art to COVID cures. It's very difficult and expensive. And one of the ways we encourage that is by having the patent system. So to me, whether I'm curing COVID and AI is curing COVID or a room full of monkeys on typewriters is curing COVID, you know, all that the patent system should care about is, You know, is this incentive creating the right sort of behavior, and are we getting the right sorts of outputs? And so for me, whether a machine is thinking like a person or semantically understands what it does is totally irrelevant to what it does functionally. You know, the same way that if my Tesla drives me from my house to my work, you know, I don't really care if it knows that it's driving me in a philosophical sense. What it is doing is identical to what an Uber driver would be doing. And thus, we should really be regulating them the same sort of way. And then I'll just toss in one final bit, which is, you know, this has been an endless grounds for philosophical debate. But some people believe that really human beings are complex biochemical algorithms who are deterministic, you know, really not that different from what AI does, clearly more sophisticated, but they're not different in kind. They're really different in sophistication. You know, other people reject that. And that's something Alan Turing addressed in the 1940s. He wrote a paper about it and said, you know, we don't really know what thinking is. And for that matter, I don't even really know that you're thinking, you know, but what does it matter? Because we just sort of go off, you know, function. And for him, you know, the test would be, could I tell the difference between an AI and a person?
I think you addressed it, but I think I have to throw it out there. So some people call the Davos project, they said it's just a, you know, a publicity stunt. And, you know, I guess what's your reaction to that kind of hostility towards what you're doing? Is it, again, kind of an anti-patent thing, or what is the...
I heard that from some people at the very beginning. Yeah. And I think those people didn't get it. And, you know, in part, it is very difficult to explain this case to the media because it's complicated and patents are complicated. And for example, you know, people were writing that machines were getting rights and AIs were going to own patents. And of course, that has never been part of this case.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult to explain the difference between something being listed as an inventor and something owning and exploiting a patent, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, some of that was the result of reporting that was kind of sensational and people not really understanding what the case was about. But I really don't hear that anymore from anyone. Well, maybe you still hear it from some people, but I think people are coming along. I think that was just sort of better education.
That's good to hear. Let's assume AIs, you could just request them, whatever, and they'll invent it for you. The problem now these days is that arguments about obviousness are made in hindsight, right? I know this idea, so now I say, of course, you know, a chemical engineer would have looked at these inventions related to hardware technology. And with AI, that makes it much simpler to make those arguments because you could say, of course, you know, anybody could have programmed this computer to look at these two types of technologies and come up with something. Are you concerned about middle period of time where such arguments are allowed? Because if somebody had to kind of spend the resources to pay the people to do a research and development to put these things together, to come up with these ideas, and then after the fact, somebody's, you know, relying on these arguments saying, well, I could have programmed an AI to do that.
Oh, yes. No, those are good points. And yes, I mean, I am a bit concerned about it in the sense that, you know, hindsight bias is really problematic for obviousness analysis. And the test is already, you know, more subjective than any other part of the patentability analysis. And those are challenging things that we haven't quite figured out solutions to. And I personally think that maybe part of the solution is greater reliance on, you know, economic factors, things like long felt but unsolved needs, or, you know, evidence of investment. And that with AI in the picture, it may be even more necessarily to do that and transition kind of more explicitly to an economic incentive sort of analysis for whether something or not was obvious.
That's interesting points. So I have two final questions. You know, we obviously spoke mostly about patents today. But in your book, you talk about, you know, it's called The Reasonable Robot, and you talk about AI and taxing AI, tort standards for artificial intelligence, and criminally punishing AI. You know, I was talking about your book with some friends, and that's the one that people had, like, they had the most trouble wrapping their minds around. What do you think will be proved to be the most controversial, and where do you see, like, kind of a law being the most catching up to which one of these areas?
You know, I think what we're going to see, what we have already seen and what we will increasingly see is, you know, more and more AI stepping into the shoes of people and doing human sorts of things. And that is going to change really every area of life, you know, in sometimes pretty clear ways and sometimes less clear ways. You know, and there isn't necessarily, you know, one set of regulations one could pass to solve the whole thing, like the EU AI regulations. You know, the issues that come up when you have a self-driving car doing the same thing as an Uber driver, but subject to different liability rules, or an AI and a person inventing something, or an AI, you know, and a person doing something that would be taxed, you know, are different. But, you know, it really is kind of something one has to look at and think through carefully in each area, but with, you know, a mind to deliberately figuring out how can we make things better for us as a society. So for the tax example, you know, if my university can replace me with a robot, which they are trying very hard to do, they don't have to make in the United Kingdom national insurance contributions for that robot.
Yeah.
So they basically save money if they can automate me, even if the machine's, you know, about the same good I am, or even a little bit worse. And it's an example of a law that, you know, no one really thought about it this way, but the law kind of pushes us to use machines even when maybe we shouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, or if you have, you know, a Tesla self-driving car, or, you know, or an Uber self-driving car and an Uber human driver, one being looked at with strict liability and one with negligence-based liability, it really puts in some perverse incentives for Uber to avoid automating even when maybe self-driving cars are safer. So,
yeah.
But I do think that this is on the public agenda, so it's a good time to be active in the space. You know, if we're coming to the final question, we have one more, but I'll maybe give you this anecdote. So my book, which you kindly enough mentioned a few times, just came out in Chinese. I found out a couple weeks ago, and I was disappointed when I looked at it that The Reasonable Robot, Artificial Intelligence and the Law by Ryan Abbott had become Rational Robots, The Future of Rule of Law by Ryan Alpert. And I do believe that all press is good press, but that would be press for Ryan Alpert. But then I noticed when I looked closely, the book was correctly translated. It's just that Google Translate mistranslated the Chinese back into English. So, you know, we're working on it, but the AI isn't going to replace us, you know, in the immediate future.
I guess you'd say a bit erotic. What advice would you give for maybe a young lawyer out there, or maybe somebody in law school who's listening to this and says, wow, what Professor Ryan Abbott is working on is so cool. He's really working on creating the future of law. What advice would you give to somebody who wants to do something like that in their career?
Sure. Well, I do think it's important for lawyers to understand technology. And I think that there is a lot of really interesting stuff coming out in this space, you know, that hasn't been really thought through that well. And I think a lot of the practitioners who've been around a long time are kind of, you know, have their own mindsets to these sort of things, and that there is a need for a newer generation to come in and, you know, approach things like, how do we do business using smart contracts and distributed ledgers? You know, how does IP work differently in the metaverse? You know, what happens when, you know, I've run out of interesting examples using futuristic technologies, but that sort of thing. And so I would encourage kind of students and younger people starting out to take an interest and to really learn the technologies well enough to, you know, understand how the law should engage with them. I think clients in these spaces are often frustrated when lawyers kind of don't understand their technology. And for example, you know, everyone tells me they have trouble finding a lawyer who really understands blockchain regulations. So there is a market to go into there. Not that you need to be coding as a lawyer. I mean, you're a lawyer, you're not a computer scientist. Although I will say someone at Google recently mentioned something about 8-figure starting salaries for people with PhDs in machine learning. So, you know, if you do decide to change your career trajectory, maybe it's not too late.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate your time. It's been great to talk to you.
No, it was a real pleasure. And, you know, let's do it again sometime.
Yes, definitely. Thank you for listening to Clause 8. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating. I'd also like to thank my firm, Harity & Harity LLP, for their generous support. Clause 8 is produced by Great Feeling Studios and Brick Brewer. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. Thanks for listening.